Just before you start listening to this podcast, a reminder that we have a special subscription offer. You can get 12 issues of The Spectator for £12, as well as a £20 Amazon voucher. Go to spectator.co.uk/voucher if you'd like to get this offer.
Hello and welcome to The Spectator's Book Club podcast. I'm Sam Leith, the literary editor of The Spectator, and this week I'm very pleased to be joined, in the run-up to Christmas, by the historian Tom Holland, whose new book is called Dominion, The Making of the Western Mind, I think is the subtitle.
Is that the subtitle? Yes.
And it's a book about the history of Christianity and its effect on the whole of Western culture. So a modest project, Tom.
Yes, and the fact that it's called The Making of the Western Mind, and the fact that there's barely a hint on the cover that it's actually about Christianity kind of points you to the way in which Christian influence, particularly in Britain perhaps, but generally across the West, has become quite occluded. It's something that the kind of people who publish beautiful history books tend not to be entirely comfortable with. But the thesis of the book essentially is that despite that, if the West is a goldfish bowl and we're the goldfish, then the waters that we swim in essentially are Christian, even though we may not appreciate it. And in fact, shortly after I finished the book, a kind of even better metaphor hit me, which was prompted by watching Chernobyl, the drama series that I'm sure some of your listeners may have watched. And in that series, there was a scene where two of the main characters are looking at the radioactivity leaking from the reactor. And you can literally see it because the air is being ionized. But of course, the impact of Chernobyl is experienced in Kiev and Scandinavia and Cumbrian hill farms by people who don't see the radioactivity, but are nevertheless breathing it in and being changed by it. And by that, I'm not going kind of Richard Dawkins. I'm not saying that Christianity makes your hair drop out and kills you, but that it continues in the air. It remains in the air. You breathe it in and you don't even realise it.
And actually,
it changes and affects you.
You do carry that metaphor through the book on several occasions. You talk about breathing in the dust.
Yeah.
But you made your name as a historian of pagans. You know, you're
a pagan, of course, is itself a Christian terminology. And this is part of why I wanted to write this book, was that writing about classical antiquity and essentially realizing that words like pagan, words like religion, words like secular were hugely problematic to use in a pre-Christian context because they are so rooted in a kind of the seedbed of Christian theology and history that to apply them to pre-Christian periods risks massive anachronism. And this was part of a kind of learning process that, whereas when I began writing books about pre-Christian classical history, I had a kind of vague sense that the modern West remained profoundly shaped by that. I've kind of changed my mind on that. I don't actually think we are directly influenced by it at all. And I think that insofar as we are influenced by classical antiquity, it's an influence that has been predominantly mediated by Christianity. And it's almost impossible to see back through this kind of haze of Christian influence back to what the world was like before Christianity. Its influence, I think, is that profound.
So was there a sort of sense in which writing about classical antiquity and, as you say early on, being an enthusiast for dinosaurs,
well, it's all about power and violence and glamour,
exactly.
And charisma,
in that stuff,
which,
you know,
which I responded to. From a very, very early age, that is what I responded to. I mean, I can mention an episode in the introduction about going to Sunday school and there being an illustrated Bible of Adam and Eve with all the animals that God had created, which included a brachiosaur. And I knew that no human being had ever seen a brachiosaur because it was a cause of constant grief and sorrow to me.
Some of our American listeners may be writing in.
And yet, for me, this was by far the most thrilling page in the whole of the illustrated Bible because it had a dinosaur. And likewise, going on, you know, if I thought about Jesus in front of Pontius Pilate, I was wholly on the side of Pontius Pilate. The eagles, the togas, the glamour of it, the power, the charisma. And it was a kind of, I suppose, a kind of lazy, instinctive, youthful response to it. But when you write about it and you think about the implications of what did it mean to live in a world unmediated by Christian assumptions, I just found it increasingly kind of alien and frightening.
And was it that the more you learned about it, the more you realised this is so different?
Yeah.
that this tells me something about.
Yeah, and it's also, you know, kind of living in the present. And in a way, Christian assumptions have been making a comeback over the period that I've been writing books. I mean, not overtly, but in the form of Me Too, in the form of anti-colonialism, anti-racism, all these things which people just kind of assume are givens. People don't say, well, why do we think this? Why do we think it's wrong for very powerful men to sexually abuse their inferiors? Why do we think it's wrong for powerful states to throw their weight around? You know, none of these questions would have made any sense at all in the pre-Christian world. And the fact that we just assume that these are givens reflects how profoundly Christian our intellectual and moral makeup is.
We'll certainly get on to the, you know, because this is a book that goes right from the very beginning right now. But you actually do start with the crucifixion itself, the sort of central emblem. And what's kind of, I think, it's a good illustration of the way in which the inheritance is sort of semi-invisible to us, or at least we're so shaped by it. That you say in the early period, the crucifixion, Christians wouldn't have made much of the image of it. It would have been sort of occluded. It would have been something down low in the mix.
Because horror and shame. A thing of utter horror and shame. And I think in a way we've become desensitized to what the cross means. For us, subliminally, it's a thing that vaguely conjures positive ideas. So if you're injured and you see a white van with a red cross on it coming towards you, you don't have to be a Christian to know that this is probably a good thing. It's a positive. Whereas for the Romans, the cross was the emblem par excellence of their right to torture and humiliate to death anyone who gave them kind of any lip at all. And it was such a disgusting death that it was regarded by the Romans as the fate that was peculiarly suited to rebellious slaves, because it wasn't just that you would suffer appalling pain. A crucifixion, there was no standard way of being crucified. It was an opportunity for the torturer to demonstrate his skill. So he might drive nails through your bones, tie you up with rope to impale you, hang you upside down, whatever. And you would be unable to ward the birds off from pecking out your eyes or attacking your genitals, and you would be suffering, you know, pulling yourself up and down, and your body would be bleeding and sweating. But your suffering would also be very, very public. And in a society where placed as heavy a premium on kind of dignity as the Romans did, this was horrifying. You became a kind of billboard for the power of the people who were killing you. And to all of this, we've become desensitized, and I had as well. And this was brought home to me when, a few months into writing the book, I went to Iraq to make a film for Channel 4 about ISIS. And we went to a town that had just been liberated by the Kurds from ISIS, but they were still kind of a mile or so absolutely within striking distance. And this town had been full of Yazidis, who were a religious minority in Iraq, who were targeted with particular cruelty, and the men, you know, the women notoriously were enslaved, but some of the men were, you know, men were killed and some of them were crucified. And to be in a town smashed to rubble, littered with corpses, exactly as the Romans would have served a town, and to know that people had imposed crucifixion on their victims in exactly the way that the Romans had imposed crucifixion, that the cross for the people who'd done this had none of the 2,000 year sediment of signification that it has for us, it opened this kind of great abyss of dread, as I kind of felt what it would be like to live in a world without that 2,000-year history. And I felt it like a kind of worm of dread in my intestines, which is exactly what the Romans used it, because that was the emotion it was designed to inspire. And yet the astonishing thing about Christianity is that it turns this emblem of imperial power into an emblem of the opposite, an emblem of the power of the victim over the victimizer.
And is that the sort of central turn? I mean, because obviously Christianity, as we'll now, I hope, go on to talk a bit more about, has taken all sorts of forms. You know, it's been intensely hierarchical and money-oriented. It's been essentially communist. It's been, you know, it's had all sorts of different redactions. Universalist, it's been, you know, particularist. It's had all sorts of different redactions. But what is the sort of distinctive central thing that you say is Christianity.
I think the cross does stand at the heart of it. The idea of the cross and then the resurrection. I mean, unless you think that Jesus is crucified and he rises from the dead, then you're not really a Christian. I mean, that's at the heart of it.
Culturally speaking, what's the thing that makes the Western mind?
I think that there are two people who bookend this book, who both recognise penetratingly just how weird and unsettling the idea that God hung from a tree and was tortured to death and suffered the fate of a slave. And the first of those, of course, is Paul, the earliest author of Christian texts, written probably within a decade or so of the crucifixion of Jesus. And he describes it as a stumbling block to the Jews for obvious reasons and a scandal to everyone else. And it's a scandal to the Romans for the reasons that I've just been explaining. And Christians feel the kind of gallows taint that hangs over the fate of Christ, as you said, to a very long time. I mean, they write about it, but they keep talking about the fact that he suffered this humiliating death as a cause of shame and embarrassment, and they kind of wrestle with it, and they cannot bring themselves to illustrate it, really, until a century after Constantine has converted. Of course, Constantine sees a cross in the sky. Even he and his heirs cannot bear to sponsor illustrations of Jesus actually hanging on the cross. And when, at the end of the 4th century, you do start to get images of it, Jesus is, you know, there he looks like kind of incredibly buff, kind of Love Island kind of thing. But, you know, he's a victorious athlete in the great contest of life. And it takes, you know, many more centuries, and specifically in the West, before you start to get images of him dead on the cross, torched on the cross, suffering on the cross.
If you talk about athlete...
And then, of course, it becomes... as I said, becomes desensitized. And then the other bookend is Nietzsche.
I was going to say, Nietzsche, Paul and Nietzsche seem to absolutely...
Yes, and Nietzsche, yeah. Like Paul, I think because he is a classicist who has a deep sympathy with the values of the ancient world that he correctly sees as being challenged and overturned by the coming of Christianity, is appalled at the idea of a crucified God in a way that many people in classical antiquity clearly were as well. And he feels it with a kind of visceral sense that most people have lost.
I mean,
and
you read Paul, Nietzsche as more or less saying the reason Christianity is such a disaster is because it forsakes the cruelty of the classical world. But Nietzsche is actually kind of a cruelty fan in your reading.
I think he is a fan of cruelty, but he sees cruelty as the necessary expression of how the strong impose themselves. So it's not necessarily cruelty for itself, but it's cruelty is a necessary corollary of the right and ability of the strong to do as they please and wish. And there is a kind of glory and splendour for Nietzsche in the exultant power that an Achilles demonstrates and displays. You know, Achilles is not massively not nice. Worrying no, about nice. All the poor people that he's slaughtering. It's not really a consideration. And Nietzsche deeply regrets that. And, of course, bastardized, this then feeds into the Nazi assumption that the Jew Paul is the great baneful influence who destroy, in Hitler's opinion, the Nordic race that occupied Greece and Rome. And Hitler blames the collapse of Greek civilization, the collapse of Roman civilization, on the kind of cancerous effect of Paul's universalism and Paul's obsession on the victim rather than on the kind of the blonde beast, the triumphant.
Well, maybe actually this is a good opportunity to go back to Paul, because his universalism you touched on seems to be the great kind of hinge, as I understand it.
Yeah,
you know, Paul,
I think
is
so.
A, so
yes.
It's a kind of franchise extension.
Yes,
you talk
I mean the thing is that
Jewish
that
monotheism.
Universalism is very much in the air that Paul is moving through, because you have successive attempts to kind of responses to the fact that the world is getting larger and larger, basically that it's globalizing. You have the Persian one right back in the 6th and 5th centuries BC, who see the world in moral terms, that the world is divided into good and evil, light and dark, truth and lie. And this is a kind of very fertile concept. Then you have the Greek ideal of universalism, which has its most successful incarnation in the Stoics, who see the divine in the whole of the universe and therefore present within every human being. And they call this spark of the divine synodesis. And Paul will take this word up and essentially use it to mean what we call conscience, the idea of the law of God that's written on the heart that everyone can see. Then, of course, there's Roman universalism, this idea of a global order that's been brought under the rule of a son of a god who has bent swords into plowshares, who has ushered the world into a universal age of peace. Lions lie down with lambs. So all this kind of imagery is there. And then, of course, you have the Jewish universalism. And Jewish culture is a kind of bandwidth. And at one end, there is the notion that the God of the Jews is the God of Israel, that he is essentially exclusively the patron of the descendants of Abraham. And then at the other pole, you have the idea that he is the God who has created heaven and earth and has fashioned every man and woman in his image. And there's potentially a massive dignity there. Paul, who is educated as a Pharisee, is absolutely steeped in the inheritance of the Jewish scriptures, moves from one end of the bandwidth to the other. To begin with, he's on the kind of exclusionary wing of it. He ends up becoming this kind of radical universalist, and he famously argues that there is no Jew or Greek, there is no man or woman, there is no slave or free in Christ Jesus.
Well, it's an extraordinary thing. You talk about his letters saying that he says these dietary laws all belong to a previous age, the standard issues of sort of Jewish exceptionalism, the sort of things that hold together the tribe of Israel. He says, since Jesus, that's all done.
Yeah.
And he's writing letters saying, you've got some other Christians coming preaching that you have to kind of be Jewish and Christian. No.
Yeah, and so Paul's letters are, they're kind of dramatic monologues. They're like Cicero's speeches where you don't have the other side at all. And they are kind of dramatic performances. Occasionally he says, I'm writing in capital letters here, I'm getting so cross, and he'll fire off rude jokes and all kinds of things. And yet, we're compressed within these letters, and there are only seven of them that most scholars accept were written by him, is pretty much everything that makes Western society today distinctive. You can trace almost everything back to these. And, there is nothing comparable to them in the entire canon of classical literature for sheer influence. And they're like depth charges placed under the fabric of everything that the Roman world had taken for granted. And we continue to feel the reverberations of those depth charges into the present.
And does, that, as you say, he's taking stuff from the Stoics. He's also, in an early chapter, you do write very...
Well, I think he's taking stuff from the Stoics in the way that we might be influenced by Marx without actually having read Capital. I think it's kind of part... Again, it's kind of stuff that's
it's the air,
dust in the air to pursue that.
Also, you do say, laying the foundations for, Christianity being a sort of radical departure from, classical antiquity, that actually Jewish monotheism is a completely distinct and not before seen formulation.
The idea that there are all kinds of things that are distinctive about it, but in terms of the way that it impacts or it's mediated through Christianity, I think the idea that there is a single deity whose will and purpose and goodness therefore explains everything. So that if you can fathom the will of the deity, then you understand not just how you should live, but in the long run, how and why the universe works, for instance. So there's a kind of Goldilocks quality to the Jewish and then the Christian God, which is that he's all powerful. He can do anything he likes, any number of miracles. But equally, this is a God who binds himself with covenants.
Yes, so he binds himself with God in Will Eisen's
phrase. So essentially he issues a contract with the children of Israel on Mount Sinai. And then again, Paul says, with the crucifixion and the resurrection, again, there is a new covenant, and this covenant is written on the heart. And so this idea that there are laws, that the spark of human rationality that is a part of God, that human beings have been created in his image, so they have this incredible dignity. Every human being has this dignity. Every human being, therefore, is worthy of a kind of inherent respect. And that spark that exists within humans in the long run will inspire Christian thinkers to imagine that if God has structured the cosmos by his laws, then the spark of reason that exists within humans should enable humans to fathom what those laws are. And the idea that the universe is structured according to laws that can be fathomed, again, is a kind of very, very radical and novel understanding that in the long run will culminate in what in the 19th century comes to be called science.
And also, even back then, there's sort of glint where you sort of say the idea, you know, to ancient Greeks that God, you know, or a god would have made a contract with human beings is kind of ridiculous. But you say it shapes the idea of kingship as well, that the sort of Jewish ideas of kingship were much more provisional and much less absolute, you know, in the sense that there is something above them. There's a sort of law, there's a set of ideas.
Yes. Greek philosophy obviously provides Christians with the idea that there is a kind of universal animating nous, intelligence that governs the world. But in the Aristotelian incarnation of this, it's very chilly and remote. It requires the love of human beings, but it offers no love back. Whereas Christians can say, this God became a small baby. It suffered death for us. It loves you. And it loves you, not just you, King, Caesar, whatever. It loves you, scullery maid who's being raped by your master every day. It loves you, beggar in the street. And it incubates the kind of radical idea that actually God may love the slave and the poor and the suffering more than he loves the king. And so there is a kind of, for autocracies, even though it does offer a lot, and this is why Constantine is a man of enormous conceit, and he aspires to rule the whole Roman Empire, and he basically wants to serve as deputy, therefore, for a single god. He doesn't want to be beholden to a multitude of gods. He wants to be the deputy of one all-powerful god, and so he auditions a number of deities for this role, and it's the Christian god who ultimately passes the audition. But by doing that, he is enshrining at the heart of the Roman Empire, and therefore ultimately of the kingdoms in Western Europe that will be planted on the ruins of the Roman Empire, this idea that ultimately slaves matter more than kings, and that the first shall be last and the last shall be first, as Jesus himself said it. So ultimately, in political terms, it's akin to building San Francisco on the San Andreas Fault. Settled orders are going to be brought down at some point. And this is what happens repeatedly. The kind of inspiration to remake, to reform, to indulge in what in the 11th century comes to be called reformatio, is hardwired into it.
And is that, you know, some might say, well, you know, you're slightly having your cake and eating it, because, of course, you're saying that the defining quality of Christianity is that when it becomes its opposite and then, you know, turns itself upside down again and has another revolution, another reformation.
But that's what a revolution literally means, of course, is that it is a turning of the wheel. And this essentially, it's very distinctively in the form of the Latin West, because what happens in the Latin West, as opposed, say, in Constantinople or later in Moscow, is that the church is able to separate itself from the idea that every state in Eurasia, from the Atlantic to Japan, has always taken for granted, which is that if an autocrat has earthly power, then he also has a stake in the supernatural. And for a whole host of complicated reasons that, again, are deeply rooted in theology, in the 11th century, revolutionaries, I think you can call them that, reformers, heretics by the standards of earlier Christians, seize control of the most significant office in Latin Christendom, the papacy, and they use it to force through a revolution which culminates in the idea that there is a dimension of the saeculum, and the saeculum means the flux of things, the span of human living memory, doomed to oblivion. And then there is the church, the bride of Christ, who therefore must be kept intact and pure and untainted by the pouring, grubby fingers of earthly monarchs. And it's the church that provides the religio, the bond, that will enable fallen humans to attain eternity. And so this idea that a kind of sovereign entity can exist over and above earthly realms is embedded in the fabric of what will become Western culture. And it's very, very radical and weird and novel. And it over the course of the centuries, this will evolve and bed down the idea that there are things called religions, religiones, and that there is a dimension of the secular. And this becomes really the kind of defining characteristic of Western society, and it's absolutely rooted in specific Christian assumptions.
Well, I'm very interested that you seem to say, which is, I haven't seen said very clearly elsewhere, that essentially the demand in the West for a secular sphere has a thumb on the scales, essentially. It's a Christian tilt, and it doesn't make sense in the context of Islam or many schools.
No, of course not. Yeah. Of course not. It doesn't make sense in actually, I mean, really, the modern idea of the secular, you know, Christians in the Middle Ages wouldn't really have understood it. I mean, they had a different, you know, it was understood theologically. But what happens then in the second process of Reformatio in the West, what we call the Reformation, the idea in medieval Europe, religio is distinctively identified with those who have a particular responsibility for bonding with God, say monks and nuns and friars and so on. But with the Reformation, that idea becomes democratized. Everyone has a religio, a bond with God. And so therefore you can start to ask the question, well, what is your religio? What is your religion? But equally, it fuses with another idea, which is that there is something called what in medieval Europe been called the secularia, things of the seculum. This comes to be called the secular. And religions are seen as things that are separate from the secular. And so when the British go to India, which they call Hindustan, inhabited by people they call Hindus, people say, what is the religion of the Hindus? I mean, it's a mad question because the Hindus don't have a, you know, they don't have a religion. It's this idea of there being a religion and secular is very Christian, and in the context of the British, entirely Protestant. But that, of course, doesn't stop the British from constructing something modelled on Protestantism that they call the Hindu religion, what will come to be called Hinduism. And the British do not convert India to Christianity, and indeed they're very concerned not to. And so there's an Indian scholar who says that Christianization proceeds in two ways. It proceeds through conversion, but it also proceeds through secularization. And in that sense, the fact that when the British leave, India becomes a secular republic, it's a massive kind of trace element of the influence of the very Protestant way of understanding the world that the British had brought. And I think that it's legitimate to look at what's happening in India now and Modi, to see what Modi is reacting against is that sense that the idea of the secular is a kind of foreign imposition. And he's quite right, it is.
So it's you talk about Christianity there in that context, you know, essentially dictating the shape of our thinking, the paradigms along which we're thinking, rather than necessarily the content. When it comes to, you know, which has been much touted back and forth, the Enlightenment, which, you know, the likes of Steven Pinker will say, you know, this was the great movement away from religion. What's, you know, how do you see it? Is it a case that your idea that it essentially follows the shape of the Christian idea that the world is decipherable?
Yeah, absolutely. So if you go back to the 11th century, this revolutionary process of Reformatio, what you see is a feeling that kings have to be humbled to ensure the freedom of the mass of the people, that ideologically armed warriors should go to the limits of the world to spread this message, that the values of this revolution have to be imposed at the point of the sword and by lawyers and by clerks who are educated in radical new institutions called universities, that those who oppose this process have to be kind of condemned as deplorables. And you see the same pattern happening in the Reformation. Only there, of course, it's the Catholic Church, the Roman Church, that becomes the object of this kind of revolutionary impulse. And you see the same thing in the 18th century with the philosophe and then with the French Revolution, only now it's Christianity itself. But the degree to which essentially Christian ideas are starting to cannibalize themselves is evident in the very word Enlightenment. Because if you go back to the Reformation, the idea of Enlightenment is fundamental to it. You know, Luther's idea that it's the illumination of the heart that enables you properly to understand Scripture is a crucial aspect of what Protestantism is all about. And it also then feeds into the idea that superstition has to be banished, that idols have to be overthrown, that the people who walked in darkness have to be brought into a great light. But of course, all these ideas are themselves drawing on Scripture. All of those ideas are deeply rooted in the prophetic writings of Isaiah and Jeremiah, the idea that priests, you know, should be banished is there in the story of Elijah and the priests of Baal. The idea that there is something called religion, which has, you know, which could count as superstition and has to be overthrown. None of this would have made any sense whatsoever to people before Christianity.
Yes, yeah, so someone previously said that agnosticism even is distinctly
impossible
Protestant.
It's impossible to. The only way really to escape the impact of it, as Nietzsche recognises, is basically to go back to the worship of power. And we see what happens when, you know, we know what a truly pro-Christian regime would look like because we had it with the Nazis.
Now, this idea of exalting the weak and, you know, this being at the central kind of insight or one of the central insights of Christianity, is that unique? Does it come from nowhere? I'm thinking, I mean,
no.
Something like Buddhism, you know, Siddhartha had to go out of his palace and walk among the...
Yes, he does. In Hinduism you have castes, and in Buddhism you have the idea that you proceed upwards through different incarnations. So to attain enlightenment, you're at the top of a pyramid, whereas the radicalism of
it's a spiritual pyramid rather than a...
Yeah, but if you do bad, you get reincarnated as something lower down the chain. So that implies that there are kind of gradations of value. Whereas in Christianity, everybody is created equal. Now, that draws massively heavily on the inheritance of the Hebrew scriptures, of course. I mean, deeply rooted in that. And it's an idea that the fusion of Jewish and Christian ideas will also obtain expression in Islam. But I think that it has a particular potency in Christianity because of the mythic power of the idea of God becoming a slave and suffering the worst fate imaginable. It enshrines it in a way that makes it a kind of the molten core of what people in Christian society assume is right, in a way that kind of transcends dictates or philosophies or whatever. It operates as a myth at the heart of our society.
There's a peculiar way, I mean, which probably bears into your thesis, that you find Christianity on both sides of certain of these very, very intense divides. So, I mean, in the modern age, you know, apartheid, you say, had a kind of Christian, almost sort of Calvinistic elect and damned rationalism, rationale behind it, and that was fighting against Christian universalism. And
Christianity, in a way, it structures paradox. You know, the God who's a man, the immortal who suffers death. I mean, paradox lies at the heart of it. But there are kind of involuntary paradoxes. And one of them is actually kind of inherent in that Pauline idea that there is no Greek or Jew, which, you know, may sound impeccably Benetton-ad. You know, I mean, who doesn't love the idea of kind of universal brotherhood or sisterhood of man? But of course, as Paul himself knows, if you're a Jew, you may not want to have your distinctiveness dissolved into a kind of universalist mush. And so right from the beginning, Christians have to face it. Well, what do you do with people like the Jews who don't want to have their distinctiveness dissolved? And the history of Christianity's relationship to the Jews is the kind of the great shadow that hangs over it. But it's not the only one, because it focuses the question of, you have a message of peace and love and universal respect for human dignity, and you are wholly convinced that these are ideals that the entire world would benefit from sharing in. But there are people who don't want to share in them. What do you do with them? Do you turn the other cheek, or do you send in the lads?
There are different answers.
And this is a tension that runs throughout Christian history and is still very much a tension that, for instance, shadows liberalism today. What do liberals do with people who don't want to be liberal? I mean, it's exactly the same problem that Alcuin and Charlemagne faced.
Will you describe the culture wars we're living through now as actually a civil war between Christian factions, which
yes, I mean, that's,
come as great to me, surprise to many of those involved?
Well, so if we look at you know, America at the moment, absolutely kind of, you know, roiled by these. What are the roots of gay rights, of feminism, of all these kind of movements that have developed since the 60s? Well, really, the paradigm is provided by the civil rights movement of the 50s, which is patently rooted in theology. You know, Martin Luther King describes Jesus as an extremist for love. And, you know, there's no Greek or Jew, there's no black or white. And so Martin Luther King's campaign is to awaken white Christians to the message of love that he feels that they've been ignoring, to the fact that they are all created equally in the image of God. And this enshrinement of love as the great animating motion convulses American politics and society and leads to legislation that attempts to right the wrongs that have been done black Americans over many, many centuries. But it gets picked up by people who do not define themselves as Christian. So in the book, I write about the Beatles, and the Beatles, when they go to America, specify that they're not going to play in segregated stadiums. They are also playing music that owes a huge debt to the music of the black churches. So in every way, they are shaped by this kind of Christian American inheritance. But they've also been brought up in an England that regards Christianity as kind of boring and dull, and the kind of thing that, you know, old women who keep their faces in jars by the door might go for, but not if you're the Beatles. And so over the course of the 60s, with the Beatles as Pied Pipers, the idea of love gets divorced from the Christian moorings. And the Beatles can sing All You Need Is Love without any reference whatsoever to Christianity. And indeed, as the career of George Harrison shows, who becomes a Hindu, you can come to regard Christianity as actually being repressive and standing in the way of a kind of universal love. And so these Christian ideals over the course of the 60s come to be given value by to the degree to which they emancipated from Christianity. And of course, the power of the civil rights movement means that other people who feel that they've been disadvantaged, gay people, women, whatever, are able to use this language and to launch campaigns modelled on Martin Luther King's campaigns. But these are more directly threatening to Christian orthodoxies as they've been understood traditionally by the churches over the centuries. And on top of that, you have the way in which, of course, love in English has a multiplicity of meanings, one of which is sexual love. And over the course of the 60s into the 70s, the idea that actually Christian sexual ethics are boring, repressive, a kind of blast of grey breath on the kind of sexual anarchy of the Roman world comes to root itself as well. And when I began the book, I did think, well, this is actually a measurable change. This is something that where clearly Christianity is on the retreat. We live in a much more overtly sexualized world. Christian sexual teachings have basically been trampled down. That's something that it does seem to be changed. But as I was writing it, the Harvey Weinstein affair broke.
Yes, no, it's extraordinary. You end with Harvey Weinstein.
And Harvey Weinstein, you know, the amazing thing about Harvey Weinstein is that nobody has really thought to say, well, what is the issue? Why shouldn't powerful men sexually abuse their inferiors? Because that's what most people in most societies have taken for granted.
Rhyme. I don't know whether deliberately or not, your description of Nero's great bacchanal right at the beginning.
Yeah, that was the echo. And if you look at Harvey Weinstein, he has a kind of echo of Nero's jowls. And I think that the irony of this is highlighted by the way in which the women's marches that were launched not just in the wake of Harvey Weinstein, but in Trump's election. The most distinctive way that women on those marches dressed was in the red robes and white bonnets of handmaids. And of course, The Handmaid's Tale is a parody, a satire on Puritanism, on New England, on the founding of America. But essentially what the women on those marches were demanding was that men behave more like Puritans, that they display a sexual continence, that they not jump, you know, women who may be inferior to them, that they don't just kind of force themselves on chambermaids or even actresses, but that they respect the bodily integrity of women. And that idea that women have a bodily integrity and that men should respect it and display a sexual continence, hard to emphasize the degree to which this, again, you know, this is not a given. It would have made no sense to the Roman world at all. And in fact, it derives again, unsurprisingly, from the letters of Paul, from the, you know, his teaching on marriage, that it's the relationship of Christ to his church. This imposes on men the obligation to behave like Christ, i.e. don't just jump the scullery maid. And it gives to women a status akin to that of the church, that they have a kind of bodily integrity. And this understanding of sexuality is like a kind of acid that over the course of the centuries eats away at everything that the Romans had taken for granted about it. And again, people may be tempted to think that something as basic as sexuality, that must be a kind of constant, it must be universal. It isn't at all. It's the Christian church programmatically rewires the way that men and women think about sex. And Me Too seems to me to demonstrate that we cannot buck that as easily as people in the 60s thought, that it remains part of our moral fabric.
You argue very persuasively that, you know, practically everything is influenced by Christianity.
I mean, obviously, in the West.
And obviously that's helped by the fact that, as you write very painstakingly in the books, you know, at various times, teachings can mean one thing and they're opposite. It encounters, you know, it encompasses paradox. Was there anything you found that you went, you know what, this doesn't fit my thesis?
Darwinism. Darwinism is the great intellectual development in Western history that owes nothing to Christianity and indeed overturns it. Because although the phrase survival of the fittest is not Darwin's own, and of course is a simplification of what Darwin was actually saying, nevertheless, I think it's incredibly telling that this is what his cousin articulates, and it's the understanding of Darwinism that gets picked up. And the idea that actually caring for those who may be disadvantaged, those who may be disabled, those who may have all kinds of problems in their life, that this is not a virtue but may actually lead to all kinds of problems with the health of the race, if you want to frame it in that way, or the health of humanity, if you want to universalize it. These are ideas that eat away at really kind of two core Christian assumptions, one being that all human beings have a kind of inherent dignity, and the other that the strong have a duty of care to the weak. And again, to go back to the Nazis, that's what the Nazis pick up on. Those are the two fundamental Christian ideas that they seek to trample down, and they recognize the scale of what they are asking of the German people, to accept that humans are not all the same, that actually there are Jews and Greeks and they are completely different, and that those who are mentally or physically defective should be eliminated. Himmler sets out a 50-year program which will result in the eradication of Christianity, which effectively he sees as being akin to the destruction of the Jews. And it's, you know, we're talking about the paradoxes of Christian history. Probably the most grotesque paradox of all is that the Jews are targeted for genocide because Hitler blames them for Christianity, which is a kind of, you know, since the Nazis are drawing on the tradition and inheritance of Christian anti-Semitism, I mean, that's a kind of peculiarly cruel, horrible thing.
First, they
want to get rid
Christ
of the Jews because they're terrified that a new Paul will emerge otherwise and destroy the thousand-year Reich. And then they've got to get rid of Christianity, which they see as a kind of cancer that's been left by the Jews. And that's the plan. Now, of course, it doesn't work and Nazism gets destroyed. But the legacy of Nazism, oddly, is that it I think has had a devastating effect on confessional Christianity, because effectively in the wake of the war, the trauma of what Europe had been through meant that from that point on, anyone in the West who wanted to know what the right thing to do was looks at the Nazis and does the opposite. So whereas previously we might have looked to the church and the figure of Jesus and the Bible for our sense of what is morally right, now we look to the figure of Hitler and do the opposite. And Nietzsche has the famous parable where he talks of, you know, God is dead, but his corpse is so enormous that it casts shadows. It's a kind of riff of the Platonic idea of people in the cave. And in a sense, since the war, the West has been looking at the shadows cast by the corpse of God, and those shadows are basically Hitler and the Nazis. And I think that that's why today, whenever anyone wants to condemn something that they regard as being particularly pernicious or evil, the words fascist, Nazi or Hitler almost inevitably going to crop up. But it kind of points to, I think, a potential problem that people who want to uphold what are basically Christian values without Christianity face, which is, how long does calling people Hitler maintain its power? And if it starts to lose his power, then what are the kind of resources that enable you to insist and infirm on things like the universal dignity of human beings or human rights or these kind of values that actually are as theological as the idea that the Lord Jesus Christ rose from the dead on the third day?
We'll have to wait and see. Tom Holland, thanks very much.
Thank you.
Thank you very much for listening. We hope you enjoyed this podcast. And if you did, we very much hope that you'll subscribe on your podcast provider of choice and or rate and review us. Well, especially if you liked it. If you hated it, don't feel you have to review it. And equally, if there's something that you wanted to ask us about, something you think we could do better or something you enjoyed, please do send us your feedback to podcast@spectator.co.uk. Thanks again for listening. And please join us for our next episode.